This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Deseret Magazine reporter Natalia Galitsa recently wrote an essay titled "Breaking a Language Barrier Brought My Family Together." She says, "My mother's native tongue divided us until I learned to speak it." We'll also talk about recent articles about the home insurance crisis and a new generation of bird watchers. Natalia Galitsa specializes in long-form features and explanatory journalism as a staff writer for Deseret Magazine. As she's passionate about human-centered and nuanced narrative storytelling. A University of Florida graduate, her past work has appeared in Miami Herald, South Florida Sun Sentinel, Pulitzer Center, and elsewhere. And we welcome Natalia Galitsa to the program today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did I get your last name anywhere close?
Yeah, you were pretty spot on, Galitsa.
Okay, all right. Let's just jump into this first story, because ordinarily I would ask you a bit about your background, but this story kind of gets us into your background a bit. So grew up in Florida, Miami area?
Yep. Yeah. I was born and raised in South Florida, Broward and Palm Beach County. So less than an hour north of Miami.
Yeah. I guess a trilingual household, kind of, right? Tell me about your mother's language, your father's language.
Yeah. So my mom is born and raised from Brazil. My dad is born and raised from Hungary. They just so happened to cross paths in Florida. Ironically, when they were learning English, actually, it's kind of a funny story. And growing up, I had a lot of exposure to especially my mom's language, just because I had more family on that side who lived in our area and would come and spend time with us. So it was something that was always around me. And I was told by my parents that at one point they were each trying to teach me their language. So Portuguese, English, and Hungarian, but that I had started to stutter as a young kid. And so my dad fell under the assumption that the languages were too overstimulating. So we pared back quite a bit and just had me focus more on English at home. So I grew up with exposure to these other pieces of myself, but not a lot of direct practice, since it wasn't, a common denominator language in our household.
What was your, I guess, is still to this day, what's your impression of the two languages, Portuguese and Hungarian? Maybe, tell us a little bit about each of those languages.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, you probably couldn't get more different, right? Mm-hmm. Culturally, too, the two places are quite different, at least in how people interact with one another, and that certainly manifests in language, where in Portuguese and certainly in Brazil, it's more common to maybe just have multiple people talking at once, right? It's a very animated, sing-songy language versus Hungarian, with like a lot of languages based in like Central and Eastern Europe. It's maybe a little bit more one person speaks at a time, a little bit more. It gives off the impression a lot of times in the public perception as being cold, but you really can't understand what somebody is saying to you until you hear the entire sentence, because a lot of times subjects will be at the end of a sentence rather than in the beginning. So the cadence and just the liveliness of those social interactions tend to look a lot different in each language. And Portuguese is, of course, very like round, where Hungarian can be like very sharp and pointed. They are just about as different as you could possibly get.
So very interesting. And language and culture bound up with each other, right? So you said, I just want to quote you from the article. You talk with Betty Yu, professor at San Francisco State University, who says, when children are younger, family language is a connector. It's a glue. And you said for the first two decades of your life, you didn't have that glue. So what did that do, not having that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It didn't occur to me until I was an adult in college and had the option to study language that this really was a piece of my life that was missing. I mean, I knew it wasn't there, of course, at least not to the same extent that I would have liked it to be, but it didn't occur to me that there was actually something that I could and should do about it. I grew up hearing a lot of Portuguese, more Portuguese than Hungarian, again, just because I had more family from that part of the world around me. And I could understand them perfectly, but I felt like when I went to speak, I was kind of stuck at a basic elementary level of the language, even as I grew older, because I wasn't growing and practicing that language as I, aged and continued on. So while my English improved and I was able to, grow older and learn more about myself and express myself verbally, I wasn't really able to do so in the same way in these other languages that were just as much of a part of me and my family. So that often meant that I felt like I was a bit two-dimensional, so to speak. I couldn't really express all of my thoughts, feelings, opinions, interests to my family members, certainly the family members who only spoke Portuguese and didn't speak English, like many of those abroad in Brazil. So that was a little bit challenging for me. And honestly, since I didn't have a lot of regular practice, I felt quite embarrassed to try, because as anyone learning a language might relate to, there's kind of that almost embarrassment and shame of wanting to communicate something intelligently and feeling like it comes out shoddy, and kind of reconciling with that error, right?
Yeah, that's why it's best to learn it as a kid, right? Because you don't have that shame, right? As a
Absolutely.
kid. I can relate to not being able to tell a joke, right? So I served a religious mission in Argentina, and the first few months I had been used to joking with my friends, right? So I'd think of a joke in my head in English, but by the time I translated it and was ready to present it, the conversation was well ahead. The timing was off, right? So people perceived me as very serious when I was, kind of jokey, in English, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that is a perfect example. Little things like that, like how we joke and maybe different mannerisms, different phrases that might be central to how we communicate. Those things get lost and you feel like you're kind of just adrift in this very basic vernacular that doesn't really reflect how you feel inside. So, yeah, absolutely. I totally relate to that as far as feeling like you're maybe not an accurate representation of yourself when you can't convey your humor.
And you write about the visit of your grandfather from Brazil, I guess, and your mother's prepping you for this, right? Obviously, be on your best behavior, but and your nervousness is I'm not going to be able to do nuance here, right? I'm not going to be able to pick up everything
Absolutely.
from him. He's not going to be able to pick up everything from you.
Yeah. So my grandfather from Brazil, who doesn't live in the United States and never has, doesn't visit entirely too often. It's quite a journey to get here. But there was this one meeting in Miami around the holidays, and this was after I had graduated undergrad. So I had just gotten out of college, and I was so excited to start my career. I had all of these ideas and all of these interesting experience that I felt like were really formative and foundational to me becoming an adult in the real world, so to speak. And these were all things that I had never really communicated in this other language, at least not to my family, right? Let alone family members who I don't see regularly and don't speak to as often. So I was very nervous. And my mom giving that classic parental spiel, just like, when you're bringing your kids around family who you don't see too often, like behave, be nice, be polite, that I feel like we can all relate to. But there was maybe another element of that, for me, at least feeling as though I was like, wow, this is going to be almost introducing myself, so to speak, as an adult, as a three-dimensional person. I'm going to be communicating a lot of these things, my college experience, my plans for my future for the first time to him. in this language.
So as you start doing research on this, you discovered you're a heritage speaker, right? And there are many, many of you guys. So define that, heritage speaker.
Yeah, right. So a heritage speaker is a speaker unlike somebody who's learning another language for the first time. It's somebody who has a tie to that language already. So linguists will define it as someone who grew up with exposure to a family language that's different from the dominant or official language in their now home country. And that's a bit of a different experience. It can certainly carry a lot more of that shame and embarrassment, right? Of maybe not feeling like you have control over it versus somebody who's learning a language from scratch who doesn't really have any ties to it otherwise, maybe doesn't feel that same level of kind of conflict with it because there's no expectation that they should know it, right? They're starting anew versus somebody who is a heritage speaker and does have, you know, let's say family who speak primarily in this language. It can feel a lot like it's a piece of themselves that they just don't have access to, a piece of their family that they don't have access to. And so it's a little bit more complicated. And a lot of times heritage speakers won't actually pursue that language due to that shame or embarrassment, at least to any level of proficiency. When I spoke to Betty Yu in the article, as you mentioned, she also was talking about how a lot of times there's kind of a generational cycle with how these languages are learned and in many cases lost, right? Especially among heritage speakers, where by the third generation of speaker of that language, that language could very well not exist anymore, right? It's not spoken by that third generation family member and therefore can't be passed down to their kids and their grandkids. So it's more likely to kind of change the demographic and just kind of cultural makeup of families and societies over time.
Yeah. So by the third generation, it's just you describe as a second generation speaker that you could understand, right? But just that feeling of shame, you don't want to respond, right? Because you might make a mistake, right? And by the third generation, in many of these families, it's gone. Also, a feeling, I guess, for you as a second generation person, a feeling that you're an imposter, right? There's also that gets larger than language, right?
Oh, absolutely. That kind of imposter syndrome. I mean, like even this conversation that we're having right now, if I didn't have the same faculty or grasp over this language, I feel like I wouldn't be able to communicate nearly half of the things that I'm saying, right? And it doesn't take away from the feelings and experiences that I am communicating about. They are true. But how do you convey that sort of thing without any sort of, you know, connection to the people that you're interacting with and trying to convey them to? That kind of imposter syndrome definitely resonated for me as a second generation heritage speaker. And it does for a lot of heritage speakers where you know that you are one thing, right? You grow up with families that are multicultural, that maybe have unique experiences that reflect that multicultural aspect. With, you know, upbringings and experiences that might differentiate you maybe in quite substantial ways from a lot of your peers who don't have that same demographic breakdown. But if you can't really convey that or communicate that or feel tied to it by that anchor of language, right, that like mutual understanding that this is the thing that binds us, then it can start to almost feel a little bit like a facade in a way. Certainly imposter syndrome arises where it might even feel like at times I couldn't call myself Brazilian or half Brazilian because I couldn't speak the language at least at a certain point in my life. And certainly with Hungarian, because I never did quite get a grasp on that. It's a much tougher language. But absolutely, it is a sense of imposter syndrome that arose for me and certainly a lot of heritage speakers, of which there are many all across the U.S.
By the way, I'm not familiar with Hungarian that much, but I you know, I have heard a lot of Portuguese spoken. I can't speak it, but beautiful language, just musical and wonderful. So in your article, you talk about hostility in many parts of the U.S., not universal, but it's kind of a historic hostility to multilingualism. I wasn't aware of this. Theodore Roosevelt, you write, I'll just quote him, "We have room for but one language in this country, and that is the English language." I wasn't aware of that, going back to Theodore Roosevelt. And then, you know, English only, many initiatives English only. So there's a current, you know, pushing against, you know, learning of more than one language.
Yes, absolutely. We've certainly come to a point in society, especially as it becomes more and more and more multicultural in the United States, that there is more acceptance than pushback. I mean, depending on where you come from, of course, there is still hostility around, you know, certain immigrants, and that sentiment seems to be rising in the United States as well. So that can definitely impact somebody's relationship to their heritage language. But historically speaking, in much more broad strokes, there is this kind of interesting relationship where America is a nation built of immigrants, right? I mean, we hear it all the time. And this pot, this melting pot of diversity and multiculturalism. But there were times where that very same bedrock of this nation's founding was shamed, right? I mean, you mentioned the Roosevelt quote and those English-only initiatives that have spread across the country. I'll mention a few of them. There's been efforts to enforce English-only speaking in Arizona that mandates that all official communications and publications of the government in Tennessee be produced in English. There's been efforts to defund bilingual education programs across the country. And as Betty Yu is quoted in the article as saying, we're among the most multilingual countries, but also one of the most ideologically monolingual. So there is this kind of very interesting relationship where, to a certain extent, we as Americans are proud of this melting pot of diversity that makes us what we are, right? But as you know, our own American identity begins to shape into something more singular, there is also this push and pull against the other cultures and identities that make up the fabric of this place, because it's maybe seen as other. And certainly it's improved over time from some of the examples mentioned in the story. But it is still a lingering sentiment, as mentioned, with some of those more recent initiatives that we see across the country.
And so different from Europe, right? Europe is kind of expected. You'll have several languages, right? Maybe, you know, smaller countries, and the country next door speaks a different language. I think Utah maybe has a little kind of different attitude. Perhaps all the missionaries going out from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints coming back with a new language.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually is a really interesting part of living here, right? Is that there is that multiculturalism because it is encouraged for people to go out into the world and have these experiences with people of different walks of life. And so that missionary work can actually bring a lot of diversity and multiculturalism into Utah. And I've certainly seen that firsthand living here and just like exploring the state. So that's super refreshing. I wish that same kind of embrace was widespread all across the country, right? But as we know that there are many states and many corners of the country that are maybe less exposed to different cultures, and that can manifest some of that maybe hostility or just kind of pushback of wanting to engage with something different than you.
Let's take a brief break, come back and continue this story. I'll give a little teaser. Natalia Galitza determined to learn Portuguese, right? To really learn it. And we'll get the effects of that in the family, especially. We're talking with Natalia Galitza. She's a reporter for Deseret Magazine. And her essay recently published in the magazine was called "Breaking a Language Barrier Brought My Family Together." We'll have more following this brief break.
A suite of seismometers on the moon may be the first to record a possible impact of an asteroid hitting the lunar surface.
Something hitting the moon like this is unprecedented, as far as we know, in history, in terms of being recorded.
NASA's return to the moon and other celestial activity creating a stir on the next Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Science Unwrapped and USU's College of Arts and Sciences, presenting Microplastic Taxis for Microbes with environmental engineers Akib Al-Mahir and Joanna Howe at 7 p.m. in the Eccles Science Learning Center on USU's Logan campus. More at usu.edu/unwrapped. This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Recently encountered a wonderful essay in Deseret Magazine called Breaking a Language Barrier Brought My Family Together. We're talking with the author of that essay, reporter Natalia Galitsa. So, Natalia, you talk about how if you're not fluent or if you have this feeling of embarrassment communicating in the heritage language, in your case we're talking about Portuguese, your mother's language, then you might not be able to access family recipes. You say, right? Not full access to the music or read the books recommended by your relatives. I want to quote from your article. As much as language can open new worlds and expand horizons, its absence accomplishes the reverse. So that was kind of an epiphany for you, I think. You recognized this, several years ago. And so what did you determine to do?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that had always kind of lingered in the back of my mind, right? I mean, I knew I couldn't communicate super clearly to my family who didn't speak English. But that epiphany that you mentioned was realizing that, you know, if there were any family documents, anything that was elucidating about the people I came from and the places they came from, the things that make me, I wouldn't really be able to understand or access them. I couldn't share, as a writer, my own stories, right? I couldn't share the books that I was reading, the music that I was listening to, and I couldn't receive that same kind of information and identity building exposure from my family members. So I actually decided to minor in Portuguese at the University of Florida. I had to take a language anyway, as I was finishing my degree program. And so I was fortunate enough to be in a place where they offered Portuguese. It's not quite as common to see in educational settings as languages like Spanish that are more widely spoken in the United States. So I felt really fortunate to have that at my disposal, and I decided to learn it. And I will say that being in an educational setting where you're around different people with different levels of exposure to the language, some are first-time learners, maybe others are heritage speakers as well, it definitely eliminated some of that shame and embarrassment, right? Because instead of being around family members who are fluent and, whether consciously or subconsciously, hope or even expect you to be fluent as well, you're in a classroom full of people who are starting at the same point as you. They don't really have a full grasp of the language. They want to improve. They're going to make mistakes. And so it makes it easier for you to make some of those mistakes in public as well. So that was a really kind of life-altering decision for me, where I was like, you know what, if I want to change this, I have to make an effort to actually learn the language. Hmm.
So what's been the effect then? I guess first of all, how do you best overcome that embarrassment, that shame? I guess the key is learn with people who are kind of on the same level as you, right? Then you have to get to a point where you can go talk to a stranger. Right, you hear somebody speaking Portuguese, and you can. Whereas before, you probably just turned away or didn't reveal that you had any Portuguese. Right, tell me about that first time when you were able to say, I speak some Portuguese, and join the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So yes, to your point, starting kind of at the same point in a room of people who are maybe similar to you in experience level and comfort level is a huge boost. But to actually learn anything, I guess, is to expose yourself to it enough times, right? And that certainly is the case for language, which people say is kind of like a muscle. You have to exercise it. And so that does include talking to strangers. And I'm naturally a little bit more of an introverted person. So going up to a stranger and chatting isn't always in my daily practice, let alone in a language where it's not my primary language. I'm not fluent, and I don't feel completely comfortable in. So I remember, when I was practicing in those college classes, I would make more of an effort to call my family members and speak to them in Portuguese and kind of overcome a little bit of that shame. But also if I ever saw someone in public who happened to be speaking the language, I would at least go to them and say, oh, are you from Brazil? Like my mom is from Brazil. I speak a little Portuguese, just to kind of have a little small talk. And many times, especially in the beginning, it would really kind of begin and end with that statement, right? Just kind of like a pat on the back. I was able to force a few words out. But more recently in the years since, it's kind of evolved into making more of an effort to at least sometimes engage in more meaningful conversations, knowing that I'll make mistakes and I'll mess up, but I'm trying. And actually, it's funny you should ask about kind of going up to strangers and talking about them, because recently, earlier this month, I was up at Snowbird's Oktoberfest, and I happened to sit across from somebody who was visiting from Brazil, and I heard her speak to her family members who had gotten up to go get food, and so it was just us at the table. And I did talk to her. I asked her if she was from Brazil. I told her a little bit about me. I told her my Portuguese isn't perfect, but I'm practicing. And we ended up talking for, maybe close to half an hour, just a little bit about everything. I learned about where she's from, her profession, kind of her experience, how she likes Utah, what she's doing while she's in town. And so kind of looking back at those beginning stages where it feels almost impossible to even force out a sentence, and, looking now at feeling a little bit confident to the point where I can engage in a conversation like that of that depth with somebody who I've never met before is extremely encouraging. And it's kind of a slow burn. It takes a while to build up that confidence, but I'm certainly glad I made the effort to learn more of the language, because otherwise I would miss out on opportunities to connect with people like that. Mm.
I find when I break out my rusty Spanish with people, and I go through the same thing, right? Because it's rusty. But people are delighted, right? They're usually, right? They give you some grace for if you don't get the grammar quite right, and just that you're trying.
Absolutely. And I feel like, especially nowadays, more and more and more, so much of our attention and our interaction is sucked in through middlemen, right? Like whether it be our phones or our other screens, where when we're out in public, certainly I'm guilty of this. I'm kind of looking down at my phone instead of looking around at the people around me and engaging with them in meaningful ways. And so kind of taking the time to initiate a conversation with somebody and kind of try to build like a meaningful moment of connection, however fleeting, even if you never see or speak to them again, is always appreciated, let alone when you see somebody who may not even be from here or who you share something with, and kind of pointing to that and building a connection based on that shared understanding that this is something of value, right? This cultural connection that you share, or this language that you're interested in, or, can try and practice with them. It ends up being a little bit more meaningful and special, as I'm sure you can even agree, busting out the Spanish when you see somebody who happens to also have that same connection.
Do you speak Portuguese with an accent?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I definitely do. And I still make lots of mistakes. Uh-huh. You mentioned grammar.
I wondered about that accent, because if people don't know, it's fine. But if people know that your mother is Brazilian, do people kind of wonder about that?
I think it is pretty clear. A lot of times in my regular day-to-day life, I'm not speaking it very often, right? back in November, I was able to go back to Brazil and visit family, and I was there for 2 weeks speaking nothing but Portuguese. So I started with that very hard accent that was immediately recognizable. But even just after speaking for like a few consecutive days, it kind of sort of melted away a little bit. And certainly now that I'm out of regular practice, it's back. But I feel like it's something that is recognizable, but can be massaged maybe a little bit more quickly than people might realize. And certainly this last visit was pretty illuminating for me in that way, where it made it clear that, yes, the accent is there. It's always going to be there if I go periods of time without practicing. But even if you speak a little bit every day, it decreases dramatically. So I still very much do have an accent, but there have been times where I was able to get around it, at least somewhat, I like to think.
It's interesting. This puts me in mind of a friend, a guitarist, who went to Brazil for a time because he wanted to lose his accent. And he's talking about musical accent, right? It's interesting that he was able to make some progress on that. What has this done in your family? You're picking up Portuguese.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, I had just recently gone back to Brazil and I was able to see family who I very rarely see. So, like my great aunt, great uncle, first cousins, people who maybe are a little bit less regular in my life and who have never even lived in the United States and don't speak very much English at all. And I was able to actually build like really meaningful connections with these people who I had never really spoken to in any depth prior to that trip. I was able to kind of recognize similarities with myself and my family, the shared interests that I have with my great aunt and great uncle, our love of some of the same authors, some of the same music, some of the same food. I was able to kind of see myself in my first cousins who I saw, kind of how we maybe look alike or talk alike or act alike in some ways. And I would have never really been able to know, and I mean really deeply know and connect with these people who share so much with me if I never crossed that language barrier. So really it just made my family feel bigger. It made my world feel bigger. And it gave me a more holistic understanding of myself too, right? Because especially when connecting with family members and you see them, you speak to them, you realize how much you have in common and how much of you really maybe comes from them in some way. It kind of connects all of these dots that you previously maybe never even thought needed connecting. So it's changed a lot for me and brought me a lot closer to people who I otherwise would have never really had as deep of a relationship with.
Oh, that's wonderful. Before we leave this article, I think we have time in this hour to fit in one more. Maybe enumerate, you do in the article, enumerate, list some of the benefits of learning a second language. And
Yeah,
there are many.
absolutely. Yeah, there are many. Of course, there are those social benefits, like I had just mentioned, connecting with people who you otherwise might not, right? Strangers who you share something in common with, family members, able to make professional and personal connections. But there are also really substantive changes to the brain when you actually take the time to try and learn a language. It can make you arguably a better and healthier person. And we know that learning a language increases empathy, that it can instill a sense of purpose, it can improve cognitive skills like multitasking, and even lower the risk and slow the effects of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. So, we know that multilingual speakers also report stronger communication skills, literacy rates, self-confidence, concentration, and creativity than monolinguals. And citing the article here, through MRI scans, researchers have even confirmed that they have more neurons and denser gray matter, which is the material in our brains that help us control our movements, memories, and emotions. So we know that are ways not only to improve our lives socially and culturally, but very substantive and tangible effects on our brains, on our health. So, I mean, that's only really the gist of it. I'm sure that there are far more benefits that were included in the research for this piece, but it can change your life in obvious and less than obvious ways. So it's definitely highly encouraged for people to try and pick up a language if they have any interest in it, let alone one they already have connection to, like heritage speakers, which is why so many school programs and universities actually stress taking a language course, just so we have access to those benefits and can grow and change in those ways.
Let's take another break. When we come back, we'll talk. I want to talk about the new birders. Your article, Generation Z's picking up binoculars and going out and picking up this old pastime that still remains incredibly popular. And now with the new generation, and you went out and participated as well. We're talking with Natalia Galitsa. She's a reporter for Deseret Magazine, and we'll have more following this brief break.
Support for UPR's Avalanche Forecast is made possible in part by our members and the Sportsman, serving Cache Valley since 1947 on Main Street in downtown Logan. Featuring women's and men's winter outdoor clothing, footwear, ski equipment, and accessories. Open daily except Sundays. Details at thesportsmanltd.com.
Utah Public Radio presents the Corner Concert Series, where we invite Utah-based musicians to our station to play for us. Our next episode features a young band based out of Orem, Utah, called Ignatius. Recorded in the corner of our studio, Ignatius is a burst of electrifying energy with sounds similar to bands like The Backseat Lovers and Del Watergap. The Corner Concert Series, Friday the 20th at 10 a.m. and Saturday the 21st at 3 p.m. Or watch the concert recording later on UPR's YouTube channel at upr.org.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Deseret Magazine reporter Natalia Galitsa. We talked about breaking a language barrier and how that affected her family. Her mother speaks Portuguese, father Hungarian. The family spoke English. We talked about that. I want to get into now for the rest of the hour another article of Natalia's. It's called The New Birders. Young people are taking up the old binoculars, the subheadline. So I guess I don't know how soon it was after you moved out to Utah, you decided to join a birding expedition. These were, I guess, all young people.
Yeah. It was surprisingly a lot of folks who were even younger than I was. I mean, substantially people in high school and fresh out of it. So it was both, you know, refreshing and reassuring and exciting, but also admittedly much of a shock to see so much of an interest in people of my generation and even younger take up this hobby that is very stereotypically associated with people who are maybe retired and, you know, older and have more time on their hands. So yeah, that was my first exposure to birding, at least formally. And I was pleased to see so much interest among younger people, which is really kind of the curiosity that drove this piece.
It used to be called bird watching. I think the term now is birding, right? You go back into the little bit of the history of this. I had not known this. A particular gentleman, Edmund Salas, I guess before him, you killed the bird and took it, took it home to study. I guess he had an epiphany. Hey, it's better to watch and to note. Tell me about this.
Yeah. So he is believed to be the first scientist to actually look at birds and study them without killing them, like you mentioned. Doing so, he realized actually offered a little bit more insight into, you know, behavior and things beyond just the anatomy and biology of the bird that you get from close range. And before the 20th century, you know, killing specimens to study them at closer range was far more common. But in 1898, it's believed that he was crouching and hiding and watching a European nightjar from afar, a nocturnal bird. And he jotted down notes in his field journal where he was able to describe their behaviors and learned a lot more than he would have if he had just kind of, you know, looked at it as sort of an object instead of a living, breathing organism. And so that is a case that he made later in a book called Bird Watching that he published in 1901, that we can actually learn more about specimens and certainly birds among them if we actually just observe them naturally in their environment. And there's a quote that he wrote in that book that says, "The pleasure that belongs to observation and inference is really far greater than that which attends any kind of skill or dexterity, even when death and pain add their zest to the latter." So it was really a pioneer in a way of kind of a bird watching, but also just this understanding that we can observe the natural world without interfering in it more physically.
So give me a range of what you do in birding. I guess you just go out and watch, right? But you can record. I think birders like to record the numbers of different species that they've observed. I guess you get out your iPhone. I guess there's a range of things you do.
Yeah, absolutely. In its simplest form, it really is just getting out and looking at birds. You can look at them just with your own eyes. You can look at them through binoculars. You can look at them through specialized camera lenses that zoom in hundreds of feet. And nowadays, a lot of younger people are actually leaning more on different apps where they can document which birds they see. You have these different programs where you can click record and record the sound of a bird that you maybe hear but can't visibly spot, and you're able to identify it that way. When you are able to successfully identify a bird, you can kind of record it in these different apps or independently. And many people liken it to kind of this Pokemon Go app that took a lot of younger people by storm, where you walked around and kind of recorded these little, you know, digital animals, monsters that you encountered out in the wild. So there's lots of different ways that you can develop a relationship to birding. It can be purely just looking at it and calling out that it exists. You can record it in a journal. You can record it digitally. There are far more options now than there used to be, and including among younger people who are maybe kind of bringing the digital aspect into birding. I've noticed a lot of, you know, social media groups and channels and pages kind of dedicated to connecting birders. And, you know, people will share what species they've seen and kind of go into different encounters that they've had. And it's just really interesting to see that at its core, a hobby that is really just about observation and can manifest in endless ways is seeming to take on a more, you know, like generationally significant digital relationship for younger people who are still finding interest in it.
I'm going to quote from your story. Gen Z generally wants to spend more time outdoors, experiences higher rates of anxiety about the effects of climate change, and reports concern for the environment and animals. So tell me about the benefits of birding. That's not only for Gen Z, but for everybody, but you're kind of focusing on Gen Z here.
Yeah, birding can actually bring people, you know, outdoors. Like you mentioned, a lot of times we're stuck inside a lot more and glued to screens, like I had mentioned earlier. And I feel like there is kind of that interest in being brought out to the natural world, even in the things that we say to one another, right? I mean, you'll hear like Gen Z people make jokes all the time when somebody is perceived to be chronically online, where someone will just say, "Go out and touch grass," right? So there is kind of that call back to spending meaningful time in the world around us and certainly the nature around us. You see that manifest differently with also a resurgence of interest in different analog hobbies, right? Like print media, vinyl records, film cameras. People are more interested in moving at a slower pace and connecting with things that were prioritized in generations before them, when the information in the digital age changed so much about what it means to meaningfully interact with the people in the world around you. So birding can actually bring us back outside. It can, you know, slow your heart rate. It can help a lot with anxiety and different, you know, mental health issues as well, because you are present. You're forced to be grounded and present in that moment. You're not distracting yourself with, you know, visual and auditory stimuli and just kind of having your brain race. Instead, you're very meaningfully and quietly observing the world around you. And so it can help a lot with just slowing down and, you know, kind of developing more meaningful relationship to where you live or where you're visiting, and understanding your neighbors, right? Your neighbors of the natural world can help you feel a part of something larger than yourself once you realize all that there is, you know, to discover around you. Certainly that was the case for me.
And you illustrating that, you say you'll go out in the afternoon, sit on your porch, watch the swallows, right? It's as simple as that. Well, we are about out of time. I just wanted to highlight another article, have people go and read it. It's a long article, well worth the read. It's from last year. What's the future of solitary confinement? And here's the subheadline. Frank De Palma spent a third of his life alone. Researchers and lawmakers only beginning to understand what that does to a person. Check out all of Natalia Galitsa's articles, but do go and especially check that one out from last year. We've been talking with Deseret Magazine reporter Natalia Galitsa, and we appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Thank you, and thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
Skywatcher Leo T here, where it's one sky, many cultures. As we navigate an odd occurrence this year in the valleys and mountains, it's known as snow, I think. We celebrate and look at the skies with a mid-February winter celebration. In the skies at night, all sorts of shenanigans happening, including a new comet flyby, shooting stars, and Saturn above the southern horizon, framing Orion from below and Jupiter moving above. And speaking of Jupiter, let's hop a ride with ESA's JUICE spacecraft on its way to Jupiter and its Jovian moons. In the meantime, you can check out the photo from the ESA on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page of the Jupiter-bound JUICE spacecraft as it turned its gaze on Solar System Traveler 31 Atlas, or 3i Atlas, the comet coming from outer space and leaving our solar system famously now, as we have documented last week with some cool photos from a deep space telescope. You can check that out on the Skywatcher Facebook page as well. The spacecraft has captured rare data on our rare comet coming out of that star system. It will be exciting when JUICE gets out to the moons of Jupiter. Launched in 2023 by the European Space Agency, the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE, is on an 8-year cruise towards the target planet. Its mission is to observe Jupiter's atmosphere and magnetosphere, as well as the large Galilean moons, including some which are candidates for hosting life. Should be exciting to see what JUICE discovers. And going to the moon soon, as NASA gets set for a second practice fueling for possible launch in March, as the agency loads more than 700,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen into Artemis II Space Launch System Thursday, February 19th, wrapping up a crucial 2-day-long test called a wet dress rehearsal. We had one a few weeks ago. Crews are hoping for an early March launch if all goes better with this fueling rehearsal, after technicians did some crucial work to fix the problem. As it is one sky, many cultures, let's take a trek to Mozambique and look at traditional star lore, which features stories of giraffes, lions, and ancestral spirits within Southern African cultural context, with some help from Africa Geographic. The Southern Cross, or Crux, is probably the most famous constellation in the southern sky. Not only does it point towards south, an invaluable navigational tool, but there are also many recognized animal associations. The most common interpretation in southern Africa is that of the four brightest stars of Crux are herd, or journey, of female giraffes, and the two pointer stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri, represent a pair of giraffe bulls in hot pursuit. Another version of the story sees the cross as symbolizing the head of a giant giraffe due to its diamond shape. Giraffe stars near the horizon also signal the start of the planting season. When looking directly south on a clear night, two smudges stand out against the clarity of the darkness. The large and small Magellanic clouds are sister galaxies of the Milky Way, locked in a gravitational war with us and each other. These two smudges in the sky have been known since ancient times, and early settlers consider them to be indicators of summer and wet weather when visible at night. Bushmen saw the clouds as a pair of celestial steenbok, which are small antelope in southeastern Africa, perhaps due to their diffused nature rendering them hard to see under less than perfect conditions, in the same way that the diminutive steenbok prefers to remain hidden. So keep those eyes open, look up, look deep, and look all around. Skywatcher Leo T.